This is Jody Apple.
In our most recent lesson, we introduced three different lines of argumentation that might be used in order to defend both the historicity of the Christ and the historical integrity of the biblical text. Those lines of argumentation are the convergence, that is, the coming together of evidence, 2, the witness of contemporary evidence, and 3, the biblical evidence argument. We started with the convergence, or the coming together of evidence. To illustrate that line of reasoning, we introduced a story. A hard-working man was beaten, left for dead, but we found out that he was alive. He spent a year in the hospital, he was released, but couldn't get a job. He worked in a circus as the man who had no face. Later, contemplating suicide, he passed by a church, went inside, and was kneeling in a pew crying when a priest who felt sorry for him promised to help him. He got him in touch with some of the best plastic surgeons in the country. The man's face was repaired, and he became a faithful Catholic. He went on, of course, to become a famous actor. Who was he? Mel Gibson, the inspiration for the movie The Man Without a Face. This account was revealed to me by a sincere and most awestruck member of our extended family. Later, we learned the truth. Here's what I want us to understand. The real facts. Mel Gibson did move from the United States to Australia when he was young. He did star in and produce a movie called The Man Without a Face. He was in a fight prior to one movie audition that left him with some cuts that required stitches. As a result of his rough appearance from the fight, he auditioned for and was given the part that he sought, his first big break in show business. Paul Harvey actually did a radio broadcast about that fight, about his rough appearance, and how he got his break in the motion picture industry. But let's consider some things that weren't exactly true. The fake facts. Though he did star in, and though he did produce a movie entitled The Man Without a Face, Mel Gibson was not the subject of the film. The movie was based on a novel by Isabel Holland about a man who was horribly disfigured in an auto accident. Mel Gibson was never beaten and left to die. His eye socket, skull, arms, and legs were never broken. His eye was not left hanging out of the socket, and his nose was not left dangling from his face. He never was a freak show at a circus. He never met and received help from a friendly priest to correct his disfigurement. Though he may have had plastic surgery at some point in his life, it wasn't the life-saving scenario told in the story. The moral of the story is well stated in the book of Proverbs, chapter 14, verse 15, where it reads, "The simple believes every word, but the prudent man looks well to his going." This sort of story, known as an urban legend, can fool and deceive even the brightest and the best-intentioned of souls. They appeal to our sense of awe and to our sense of wonder, and they always play on our emotions. They usually have a grain of truth at their core, but ultimately they have so much error and so much falsehood mixed together that it takes too much time to dig in and find out exactly which parts are true and which parts are false. It's so much easier to just accept them or reject them as whole cloth. Searching for truth is hard work. It's always easier to believe a lie or a half-truth. Sad to say, our attitude toward urban legends is often reflective of our attitude toward spiritual truths. Now, let's look at a serious case. Our next example of history is as heavy-handed and as somber as our first was light and frivolous. In recent years, a number of hate groups have captivated national and international attention. They have done so in part because of their militancy, because of their violence that they engage in, and because of the repulsive teachings that they promote. Without exception, some of these hate mongers target specific religious, ethnic, cultural, and national classes of people for their vehement doctrines and their disgust. It's been most embarrassing, for example, that there exists, a half century plus after the end of World War II, a new generation of neo-Nazis that have resurrected the dreaded tenets of anti-Semitism. Many of the principles and beliefs they espouse are parallel, if not identical, to the propaganda that was promoted during Hitler's reign. And, with the same degree of detestation, they have directed their abominable teachings toward the same classes of people as the Nazis did well over a half century ago. As horrible and as repulsive as the revival of Nazism might be, there are other beliefs that are just as loathsome. Under the guise of history, there exists a growing number of people whom we might declare to be radicals, who, though they might not physically attack or verbally vilify targeted groups, will nonetheless deny, and vehemently so, that historical atrocities like the Jewish Holocaust ever occurred. They revise history to disallow what might otherwise be known. As we just mentioned, one of the principal tenets of historical revisionist groups is very astounding. They deny that some atrocities that have been historically documented ever occurred. Their denial, in addition to being startling and amazing, nonetheless provides an interesting test case that relates to our own question. We want to know whether or not compelling evidence exists that yields faith in Jesus Christ as the Messiah. And in pursuit of that goal, we must ask questions. 1. Are historical facts, persons, events, even subject to knowledge? And 2. How can we know such historical facts, persons, events, and so forth, whether or not they really are real? It's easy to answer the first question, yes. But providing the proof that lies behind that answer, which yields the answer to our second question, that one's not quite as easy. But it forms the center of what is needed to answer the problem that the revisionists raise by denying the murder of millions of Jews, as well as answering our equally important, from the standpoint of the reliability of history and man's salvation, question about the reality of the historical Jesus. So, how do we go about proving the reality of the Jewish Holocaust in anticipation of a method that we might develop to demonstrate the reality of the historical Jesus? In an article a number of years ago in Skeptic magazine, Michael Shermer addressed and replied to the revisionist attack on the history of World War II and refers to the method, in part at least, that leads to understanding how the past can be both known and understood. Michael Shermer built on the work of a 19th century philosopher and educator, William Whewell, and author of several series of works on the history and methodology of the sciences. Here's what he said. Accordingly, the cases in which inductions, that's drawing facts together from multiple sources, from classes of facts altogether different, have thus jumped together, that is, they converge, belong only to the best established theories which the history of science contains. And, as I shall have occasion to refer to this particular feature in their evidence, I will take the liberty of describing it by a particular phrase, and I will term it the consilience of inductions. Now, that term that he used is one that we are using, only we are calling it the convergence of evidence rather than consilience of inductions. That phrase is significant. It means that there can be independent lines of evidence which simultaneously authenticate each other. His contention, developed and explained primarily with regard to scientific achievements and theories, nonetheless has application beyond the realm of science. He says this, "We may best hope to understand the nature and conditions of real knowledge by studying the nature and conditions of the most certain and stable positions of knowledge which we already possess. And we are most likely to learn the best methods of discovering truth by examining how truths, now universally recognized, have really been discovered." It's in this context that he maintains that the means of attaining knowledge share a pattern across all disciplines, that there is a universal method of discovering and ascertaining truth in every discipline. William Foxwell Albright, a well-known American archaeologist of a generation or two ago, says this, "To the extent that the writer deals with historical problems, he employs the same analytic and synthetic methods which have proved so successful elsewhere in reconstructing the historic past." Here's what we need to know. Michael Shermer, taking his cue from this idea of the convergence of evidence, builds several multifaceted lines of argumentation, all of which point to the same conclusion. The Nazi Holocaust was real. His lines of evidence are as follows. Number one, written documents. There are hundreds of thousands of letters, memos, blueprints, orders, bills, speeches, articles, memoirs, and confessions that attest to the truthfulness of this historical act. Number two, eyewitness testimony. Accounts from survivors, from capos, Sonderkommandos, SS guards, commandants, and so forth, and even upper echelon Nazis who did not deny the Holocaust. Number three, there are photographs, official military and press photographs, civilian photographs, secret photographs taken by survivors, aerial photographs, German and Allied film footage, and so forth. Number four, the camps themselves, many of the concentration camps or the work camps or the death camps, are still in existence in varying degrees of originality and reconstruction. And number five, the negative evidence. If 5 to 6 million Jews were not killed, where did all of those people go? Shermer introduced these five lines of reasoning to support scores of references to historical evidence, documentation, photographs, films, diaries, personal testimonies, and places, all of which cite thousands upon thousands of eyewitness and documentary evidence leading to the same conclusion. The Holocaust really occurred. Our purpose is to demonstrate that the same lines of thinking and gathering of evidence can also demonstrate the historicity of the Christ.